Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. From the Road to Tycho, a collection of articles about the antecedents of the Lunarian Revolution, published in Luna City, 2096. For Dan Halbert, the road to Tycho began in college, when Lisa Linz asked to borrow his computer. Hers had broken down, and unless she could borrow another, she would fail her midterm project. And there was no one she dared ask, except Dan. This put Dan in a dilemma. I mean, he had to help her, but if he lent her his computer, she might read his books. Aside from the fact that you could go to prison for many years for letting someone else read your books, the very idea shocked him at first. Like everyone, he had been taught since elementary school that sharing books was nasty and wrong, something that only pirates would do. And there wasn't much chance that the SPA, the Software Protection Authority, would fail to catch him. In his software class, Dan had learned that each book had a copyright monitor that reported when and where it was read and by whom to central licensing. They used this information to catch reading pirates, but also to sell personal interest profiles to retailers. The next time his computer was networked, central licensing would find out. He, as computer owner, would receive the harshest punishment for not taking the pains to prevent the crime. Of course, Lisa did not necessarily intend to read his book. She might want the computer only to write her midterm. But Dan knew she came from a middle-class family and could hardly afford the tuition, let alone her reading fees. Reading his books might be the only way she could graduate. He understood this situation. He himself had had to borrow to pay for all the research papers he read. 10% of those fees went to the researchers who wrote the papers. Since Dan aimed for an academic career, he could hope that his own research papers, if frequently referenced, would bring in enough to repay his loan. Later on, Dan would learn there was a time when anyone could go to the library and read journal articles, and even books, without having to pay. There were independent scholars who read thousands of pages without government library grants. But in the 1990s, both commercial and nonprofit journal publishers had begun charging fees for access. By 2047, libraries offering free public access to scholarly literature were a dim memory. There were ways, of course, to get around the SPA and central licensing. They were themselves illegal. Dan had had a classmate in software, Frank Martucci, who had obtained an illicit debugging tool, and it used it to skip over the copyright monitor code when reading books. But he had told too many friends about it, and one of them turned him into the SPA for a reward. Students deep in debt were easily tempted into betrayal. In 2047, Frank was in prison, not for pirate reading, but for possessing a debugger. Dan would later learn that there was a time when anyone could have debugging tools. There were even free debugging tools available on CD or downloadable over the net. But ordinary users started using them to bypass copyright monitors, and eventually a judge ruled that this had become their principal use in actual practice. This meant that they were illegal. The debugger's developers were sent to prison. Programmers still needed debugging tools, of course, but debugger vendors in 2047 distributed numbered copies only, and only to officially licensed and bonded programmers. The debugger Dan used in software class was kept behind a special firewall so that it could be used only for class exercises. It was also possible to bypass the copyright monitors by installing a modified system kernel. Dan would eventually find out about the free kernels, even entire free operating systems that had existed around the turn of the century. But not only were they illegal, like debuggers, you could not install one if you had one without knowing your computer's root password. And neither the FBI nor Microsoft support would tell you that. Dan concluded that he couldn't simply lend Lisa his computer, but he couldn't refuse to help her, because he loved her. Every chance to speak with her filled him with delight, and that she chose him to ask for help, that could mean she loved him too. Dan resolved the dilemma by doing something even more unthinkable. He lent her the computer and told her his password. This way, if Lisa read his books, Central Licensing would think he was reading them. It was still a crime, but the SPA would not automatically find out about it. They would only find out if Lisa reported him. Of course, if the school ever found out that he had given Lisa his own password, it would be curtains for both of them as students, regardless of what she had used it for. School policy was that any interference with their means of monitoring students' computer use was grounds for disciplinary action. It didn't matter whether you did anything harmful, the offense was making it hard for the administrators to check on you. They assumed that this meant you were doing something else forbidden. They did not need to know what it was. Students were not usually expelled for this, not directly. Instead, they were banned from the school computer systems and would inevitably fail all their classes. Later, Dan would learn that this kind of university policy started only in the 1980s, when university students in large numbers began using computers. Previously, universities maintained a different approach to student discipline. They punished activities that were harmful, not those that merely raised suspicion. Lisa did not report Dan to the SPA. His decision to help her led to their marriage, and also led them to question what they had been taught about piracy as children. The couple began reading about the history of copyright, about the Soviet Union and its restrictions on copying, and even the original United States Constitution. They moved to Luna, where they found others who had likewise gravitated away from the long arm of the SPA. When the Tycho Uprising began in 2062, the universal right to read soon became one of its central aims. That was The Right to Read, a dystopian short story by Richard M. Stallman and published in 1996. I read this off the Nakamoto Institute, and I had never actually read this piece until very recently, and I was like, oh, this is a really fun one. It was neat, and particularly one that is in 1996, and there's a great author's note that has been updated a number of times since the publication of this story, apparently, and we are going to jump into that in just a second. A thank you to the Nakamoto Institute for putting this in your list so that I could just stumble upon it, because this was a pretty neat little piece, so I thought I'd throw it in the middle of the week here. I thought it'd be fun to do. So let's hit our sponsor real quick, and then we'll jump back, and I'll read through the author's note, which is really interesting about kind of what degree of reality this fiction story has, and a bunch of other stuff, and then we'll jump into commentary. Author's note. This note has been updated several times since the first publication of this story. The right to read is a battle being fought today. Although it may take 50 years for our present way of life to fade into obscurity, most of the specific laws and practices described above have already been proposed. Many have been enacted into law in the U.S. and elsewhere. In the U.S., the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, established the legal basis to restrict the reading and lending of computerized books and other works as well. The European Union imposed similar restrictions in a 2001 copyright directive. In France, under the DADVSI law adopted in 2006, mere possession of a copy of DECSS, the free program to decrypt video on a DVD, is a crime. In 2001, Disney-funded Senator Hollings proposed a bill called the SSSCA that would require every new computer to have mandatory copy restriction facilities that the user cannot bypass. Following the Clipper chip and similar U.S. government key escrow proposals, this shows a long-term trend. Computer systems are increasingly set up to give absentees with clout control over the people actually using the computer system. The SSSCA was later renamed to the unpronounceable CBDTPA, which was glossed as the Consume But Don't Try Programming Act. The Republicans took control of the U.S. Senate shortly thereafter. They are less tied to Hollywood than the Democrats, so they did not press these proposals. Now that the Democrats are back in control, the danger is once again higher. In 2001, the U.S. began attempting to use the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, FTAA, treaty to impose the same rules on all the countries in the Western Hemisphere. The FTAA is one of the so-called free trade treaties, which are actually designed to give business increased power over democratic governments. Imposing laws like the DMCA is typical of this spirit. The FTAA was effectively killed by Lula, president of Brazil, who rejected the DMCA requirement and others. Since then, the U.S. has imposed similar requirements on countries such as Australia and Mexico through bilateral free trade agreements, and on countries such as Costa Rica through another treaty, CAFTA. Ecuador's President Correa refused to sign a free trade agreement with the U.S., but I've heard Ecuador had adopted something like the DMCA in 2003. One of the ideas in this story was not proposed in reality until 2002. This is the idea that the FBI and Microsoft will keep the root passwords for your personal computers and not let you have them. The proponents of this scheme have given it names such as Trusted Computing and Palladium. We call it treacherous computing because the effect is to make your computer obey companies even to the extent of disobeying and defying you. This was implemented in 2007 as part of Windows Vista. We expect Apple to do something similar. In this scheme, it is the manufacturer that keeps the secret code, but the FBI would have little trouble getting it. What Microsoft keeps is not exactly a password in the traditional sense. No person ever types it in a terminal. Rather, it is a signature and encryption key that corresponds to a second key stored in your computer. This enables Microsoft, and potentially any websites that cooperate with Microsoft, the ultimate control over what the user can do on his own computer. Vista also gives Microsoft additional powers. For instance, Microsoft can forcibly install upgrades, and it can order all machines running Vista to refuse to run a certain device driver. The main purpose of Vista's many restrictions is to impose DRM, digital restrictions management, that users can't overcome. The threat of DRM is why we have established the Defective by Design campaign. When this story was first written, the SPA was threatening small internet service providers, demanding they permit the SPA to monitor all users. Most ISPs surrendered when threatened because they cannot afford to fight back in court. One ISP, Community Connection in Oakland, California, refused the demand and was actually sued. The SPA later dropped the suit but obtained the DMCA, which gave them the power they sought. The SPA, which actually stands for Software Publishers Association, has been replaced in its police-like role by the Business Software Alliance. The BSA is not, today, an official police force. Unofficially, it acts like one. Using methods reminiscent to the erstwhile Soviet Union, it invites people to inform on their coworkers and friends. A BSA terror campaign in Argentina in 2001 made slightly veiled threats that people sharing software would be raped. The university security policies described above are not imaginary. For example, a computer at one Chicago area university displayed this message upon login. This system is for the use of authorized users only. Individuals using this computer system without authority or in the excess of their authority are subject to having all their activities on this system monitored and recorded by system personnel. In the course of monitoring individuals improperly using this system or in the course of system maintenance, the activities of authorized user may also be monitored. Anyone using this system expressly consents to such monitoring and is advised that if such monitoring reveals possible evidence of illegal activity or violation of university regulations, system personnel may provide the evidence of such monitoring to university authorities and/or law enforcement officials. This is an interesting approach to the Fourth Amendment. Pressure most everyone to agree in advance to waive their rights under it. Bad news. The battle for the right to read is already in progress. The enemy is organized, while we are not, so it is going against us. Here are articles about bad things that have happened since the original publication of this article. Today's commercial ebooks abolish readers' traditional freedoms. A biology textbook website that you can access only by signing a contract not to lend it to anyone else, which the publisher can revoke at will. Electronic publishing, an article about distribution of books in electronic form and copyright issues affecting the right to read a copy. And books inside computers, software to control who can read books and documents on a PC. If we want to stop the bad news and create some good news, we need to organize and fight. The FSF's Defective by Design campaign has made a start. Subscribe to the campaign's mailing list to lend a hand, and join the FSF to help fund our work. And again, that was the author's note from The Right to Read, and this was all made available by the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute at nakamotoinstitute.org, and that was all written by Richard M. Stallman. Richard Stallman is the founder and president of the Free Software Foundation, and also launched the GNU Project. So he's been a longtime pioneer of the whole free software movement and open source society. So I'm really glad I stumbled upon this. Again, I was actually just going through the Nakamoto Institute thing, like just looking for something to read, and there it was. I didn't know it, and anything that says a dystopian short story is something I'm probably going to click on and check out. And sure enough, it was really good. I really love those little pieces of history. I like that, like the perspective in, 1998 that was written, and it's pretty crazy how much of the law itself is written. And it's one of those things where I think there's a lot of situations where they lay the groundwork for attacking people in a very broad set of vague legalese, and then they only attack people as they need it. It just becomes basically a any shape, anything that you want hammer to attack the people that are important, and it creates essentially a job for these intermediate institutions to literally just sue people from the beginning, like just for indefinitely, to just go out, find people, and sue them. And it's a great way to make money and wrap people up and keep a bloated, ridiculous court system busy. But often just, like, our legal system is in such a horrific state that often just being accused, just having a prosecutor being charged with something is basically the end of a successful, like it can destroy you just to be sued, even if you come out innocent or to be prosecuted for some of these crimes, even if you are completely innocent, or if the crime is incredibly, like, just trivial or seemingly arbitrary, there's this huge system where they tack on just this mountain of ridiculous claims. Like these, because the laws are so vague, they can get you for like 20 different violations on like one simple thing. And then, because you're looking at like, you know, multi-million dollar, court case, which will absolutely obliterate anybody financially, then they offer you a plea deal just to make you a felon so that you can plead guilty to, you know, half of them or something and only spend a tenth of this ridiculous life-killing sentence in prison. And basically they get to push, they incentivize and force innocent people to take the plea deal because they have no other option. They can't afford the case. And the prosecutors basically have, you know, it's the state prosecuting them. So they essentially have unlimited funds and they can wrap it up and drag it out as long as they possibly can. And so even innocent people are led to take these plea deals, do short prison times, and be marked a felon for stuff that they didn't even do or for stuff that's absolutely ridiculous that it's even against the law. And there's a risk to these things. I mean, luckily, the attack surface that they have to go after, like the number of people violating these ridiculous laws, is so great that it doesn't, like the idea that like someone else has not read like my ebooks or something is hilarious. Like to try to get that level of control, and they are trying, and they have worked very hard to push a lot of just ridiculous laws through. And again, I don't think it would be something where even if something like SOPA had been passed or SEPA, all the PIPA, like there was like, I swear it was like seven or eight of them back to back trying to get utterly insane copyright restriction, stuff that didn't even exist in the physical world before, like the stuff that was levels of control that you couldn't even be granted when you were selling albums. Like now they're requesting individual, you know, like monitoring on computers for people and DRM style systems to prevent people from sharing or lending their computers to other users and stuff and allowing them to actually read their books. It's really nuts. Some of the stuff has gone into it. Luckily, everything that I have seen has mostly been shut down, but a lot of the really bad laws are actually already in place. But an example of that I immediately thought of when I read this about the whole finding someone, figuring out how to accuse someone or charge someone with a ridiculous number of crimes and putting them in the, like, your whole life is over position, or take our plea deal and admit your guilt, was the story of Aaron Schwartz. If you haven't seen, there's a documentary called The Internet's Own Boy, I believe. Yeah, I think that's right. And it's about Aaron Schwartz, who he helped develop the standards for RSS, and was an activist, fought against NSA and SOPA, I think, one of the early, like, SOPA, SEPA people, whatever they were, had a big hand in that. He actually got inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame after he died. But he was, the details that I remember, the important details were that he had access to an MIT library, like online database of academic papers. And I believe, if I remember correctly, it was like a subscription-based thing, and then they would give access to certain people or you could like rent out laptops. I can't remember exactly what the thing is, but basically he was trying to make all these academic papers available to anyone, And he put a hooked a computer, like a laptop, into a like a utility closet or something like that, and hooked it directly into their servers, and downloaded, sent millions and millions of requests to download every single PDF. I think he grabbed something like 3/4 of the entire database and downloaded it on this laptop. And they caught him, and he was charged. The state prosecuted him against, which is a simple, this act of piracy. And he was given access, if I remember correctly. It's not like he was, like he broke into MIT to do this. Like he just grossly violated the intent of the system that he was supposed to be able to look up and just download a PDF or something. And of course, he made a bot that was going to just pull things from the entire server. I think they actually had to, like, the server was almost like unusable during the time that this was going on, and they had to like shut down everything and like firewall and like ban his IP address and all this stuff. So it was like it made a big stink, and everybody was like, "What the hell was going on?" But he got accused. The prosecutors charged him with, like, I got some notes here. Where are they? Indicted by a federal grand jury on charges of wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawfully obtaining information from a protected computer, recklessly damaging a protected computer. A couple months later, they added breaking and entering with intent, grand larceny, and unauthorized access to a computer network. And at some point, they just kept stacking on charges months and even like a year after this thing. And the criminal penalties that he was looking at seeing were up to 50 years in prison and $1 million in fines. And he's already having to deal with, he'd been obliterated of money throughout this process. They tried to get him on a plea deal to 6 months in a low security prison if he pled guilty to 13 federal crimes and, became a felon. They rejected that deal, and after like a couple of back and forth, they were out of money, and it was he saw no hope in actually getting anywhere, and committed suicide for downloading without permission a bunch of academic papers off of an MIT library. And what's even more insane, I actually cannot confirm this detail, so I could be wrong, but again, it's also really, really old news now. This was back in 2014. Well, sort of old news. Old news in terms of Bitcoin years. But the MIT actually, a couple of months later, actually released the whole database and just made it open to the public, I think. I remember that detail sticking out to me, particularly when I was reading this, well, basically back in 2014 and 15, actually. Even though I couldn't confirm it, I was like, I got that impression. So if anybody else knows or can confirm, that would be cool, but take that with a grain of salt. And apparently MIT did not back him up at all. And the prosecutors just had their heyday in just how many things can we get him for? Like that, just that list that I read off is like redundancy on top of redundancy. Like he didn't commit 19 crimes. He plugged in a computer and started downloading something he didn't have permission to download. And the idea that, like, it's just utterly insane. 50 years. Like all of the idea that this was some horrible malicious intent. Like he wasn't going to sell it. This was not him trying to set up a competing academic database and make millions of dollars off of this. He just thought it was stupid that you had to pay for a bunch of academic papers, which his whole history backed up. Like that's what he was all about, was freeing information and creating free open source software, stopping all the absolutely insane copyright stuff. And because he was an activist, that was probably why they so gleefully decided that they were just going to obliterate this man's life and make him an example of just how far they will go to destroy people who challenge the status quo on copyright. And I personally am not 100% sure. I've talked about this a lot on the show, but I'm basically against intellectual property. The more and more I've read about it, I always felt that there were like certain conditions that were certain situations where I was a little iffy about it. And we may actually go into this. There's a really good piece that I might cover on the show, because I think this is relevant, really relevant, actually, to the whole crypto economy and what kind of decentralized and like a lot of this really is about open information. And open source is deeply embedded in the philosophy that information should be free, that information should be freely available to everyone if it, you know, betters lives and stuff. So, or at least in the idea that, like, you don't have your life obliterated, that the punishment has to fit the crime. And it makes no sense for the mere copying of someone else's files to be treated so insanely. So this is just a really important topic that I think we will probably be revisiting on this show, which I really have not dug into much. So again, I'm really, really happy I stumbled upon that. I thought that was a pretty fun, cool little story, and leads into some really great discussion and maybe further explanation as I find some really good pieces to do so on the whole idea of the free software movement, the idea of free information and open source society, which is clearly at the heart of the history and the foundation of Bitcoin and the crypto economy. That was the cypherpunk's thing, you know? So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. A huge thank you again to the NakamotoInstitute.org for making this available, and a shout out to Richard Stallman for the amazing work and the decades-long fight that he has put up to preserve our right to read. All right. Thank you guys for joining me. This is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan, and I am the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Don't forget to subscribe to the show and follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. This is where we read and make the most incredible written works from hundreds of brilliant authors available in audio, so that we can all actually consume these brilliant ideas and glimpse all of their perspectives on this new technology and economy that's being built. And then we get to break down the impact that these technologies could have and, you know, get some degree of clarity on the future that we want to be building. So if you appreciate what I'm doing, please consider becoming a patron and supporting my work. And a huge shout out to Jesse Lawler at Lawlerpalooza for being our first patron on Patreon. He is a really good friend and has been helping me out with a ton of stuff in the past. And it's good to have him as part of the little crew of contributors that we've got now in the Crypto Economy Telegram group. So if you want to be a part of the crew, come check me out on Patreon. I am at The Crypto Economy up there as well. I will have the link in the show notes for everybody. Love you guys. Don't forget to share this out with everybody you know who's looking to be a citizen of the crypto economy, and I'll catch you on the next episode. Until then, take it easy, guys.